I mean, if your record sounds good in a car stereo, the chances are that that it's going to sound good everywhere else. But there are tricky things, yeah.
The moment of truth. The car test.
Yeah, yeah.
Has to be done.
A moment of disappointment.
Hello and welcome back to the Music Creative Podcast with me, Hugh, or 93 Acres. And I nearly forgot the name of the podcast because one of my best friends is here. Ben, how are things?
Things are good, Hugh. How are you?
I'm very good. If I can remember the name of the podcast, we'll be good from here. Today, we're going to be talking about albums. Why should you release an album? And then the process that goes into making an album and all the creative ideas and control you have within it and any problems you might come across as well. And so we're going to introduce our friend Ben, who you might have heard me talk about in episode number one. He was one of my best friends all the way through school, and we've been making music with each other since then. So Ben, describe yourself as a musician.
Yeah, well, I suppose I'm a bit of a, I would often say that I'm a jack of all trades and master of none, which is to say that I'm not particularly great at playing any one instrument or at any one aspect of composition or production, but I tend to think that I've got a pretty good handle on understanding a little bit of everything rather than specific things in a lot of detail. So I think that sort of characterizes me as a musician.
And some jack indeed. Well, I also want to go further on that. You have literally played all types of music, whether it's like orchestral, writing film scores, electronic music, techno, folk music, musicals, the whole lot. You've really challenged yourself to take part in all the different types of genres of music, which has really stood to you over time. As we can see, you're living the professional musician life over in Berlin at the minute. And how's Berlin treating you?
Yeah, well, I'm actually back in Ireland at the moment, but I am self-isolating in my room with COVID, actually. But generally speaking, Berlin is treating me very well. We could talk for ages about the move to Berlin, but I won't bore people. But yeah, we moved to Berlin as a band about 4.5 years ago and have been there ever since. And I find that it's a really good base for me to work creatively at the moment.
And one question I love to ask people that come onto the podcast, well, you're our first guest, but I will love to, I'll enjoy this question. When did you realise, or when did you decide, okay, I'm going to take music full time?
That's a good question, because I don't know. The first thing I ever, I'll go back a little bit further, because I was thinking about this the other day, Hugh, I thought you might enjoy this, that my first ever endeavor in music was learning the recorder, and I believe that I was learning the recorder with your brother, which is funny to think about it now, because we didn't really know each other back then as kids. And I remember I used to really enjoy not so much the music, but at the end of the lesson you would have a moment where you would basically have a held a breath competition where and see who could play the longest note on their recorder, and that was my favorite part of the I'm giving you way too long an answer to a simple question here, but so that was the first thing I did. And then I obviously, as all kids do, got very bored of the recorder and decided to take up the guitar, which I gave up a couple of times, and was more into sport and that kind of thing. And at some point, I guess I was just getting quite into listening to music, not really playing music, when I was 13 or 14, and we would have been, in school at the time, and there was obviously a music class in school, and I thought, oh, that's kind of cool that people get to study music while, that's an interesting thing to be doing in school rather than just maths or English or Irish or whatever. So yeah, at some point I just picked up the guitar again, and this time without lessons, and kind of just got into it myself and started teaching myself. And I think once I was, started getting really into just like playing, learning all the chords and learning how to play all the tracks that I really liked, at some point I was like, yeah, okay, I think I want to be a musician. actually. So I would say probably around, yeah, probably around 14 or so, I kind of thought, even though I would have been, you know, particularly unskilled compared to a lot of musicians at that age, I thought, yeah, that this is something I think I would really like to do. You know, once the dream of being a professional footballer has well and truly died.
I don't know, there's still hope, Ben, there's still hope. Send a message to Jurgen Klopp. Well, it's funny because, like, when I ask you that question, it's interesting. I feel like since I've known you, which was about that age, 13, 14, you had such courage. Like, it was nearly as if you weren't going to do anything else in a lot of the time. Like, Ben was just going to do what Ben was going to do, and you just felt very, you know, confident. I suppose also having the intelligence to be able to succeed at anything you do is always an advantage. But, you know, out of anyone I've known who's gone full-time into music, you never really doubt yourself. Would you agree with that?
Well, it's nice to hear you say that. I think I did have good level of confidence that things would, I mean, when you say like things would work out, like I'm not making a great living right now. So it's not like, I can't say that, oh yeah, I've made it and that's kind of it. But yeah, I definitely have always kind of worked with the mindset of like, you have to believe that things are going to work out if you put your mind to what you're doing. And I definitely did feel that way in school, but there was other aspects of me. I mean, I was seriously lacking in confidence in many respects. I think it probably just wasn't obvious, but one of them definitely was songwriting. Like, I and it's still something that I struggle with from time to time, but I mean, in school I couldn't commit to just having really fully written songs, and you would have known that because you were in a band with me at the time, and it was something I found actually very difficult. And even though I knew it was somewhere inside of me that was something that I was going to do someday, it was kind of like I was confident about it in the like that things would work out in the future, but in the moment I definitely have struggled at times with a lack of confidence in my own ability.
And so how did you bring yourself from someone that was learning songwriting and aware you wanted to get better at it? How did you bring yourself to the level to where you now are writing, you know, album after album?
I think it's important to be around, or at least it was. I mean, everyone's different, right? So for me, it was very important to be surrounded by other people who were writing songs. You know, I was never like, and that's probably why I never really got many songs written when I was in school, is because I'm not the trailblazing figure. Like, I kind of needed to see it being done around me to really believe that I could do it. And I think I went to university and studied songwriting with a bunch of people who had been writing songs for years, and my first couple of weeks there I was like had a serious crisis of confidence, even more so than when I was in school, and I thought this is not I'm not ready for this, and I probably, you know, big imposter syndrome, and I really tried to drop out actually. And someone in the university basically talked me into giving it a go for a year, and yeah, I basically just found in that year that by just calming down a little and really taking in what the people around me were doing and learning from my classmates and from my peers, that it was something that I relaxed into the process and found, oh yeah, no, I can actually write tunes, and I really, really love it as well. So, but the main thing for me was to be surrounded by other people who are doing it. Like, that gave me the confidence and the belief.
And then fast forward to when you finished college, you'd already met two really great friends who you decided to start a band with, or well, join Neil Foote and his ventures. The Neil Foote Experience.
Yeah, that's the name of the band, yeah. We actually met in that first year of university, and again, that was another huge sort of confidence boost for me at the time. Was, you know, I was feeling like I was starting to find my feet and I was getting into stuff in university, and of course I'd met Neil and Calvin, who are both brilliant songwriters who I was, you know, we were kind of grouped together from day one. We just kind of randomly ended up in a group together and thought, these guys are like serious, they're like great writers and really nice fellas. And yeah, a couple of months later we were in a band together, so that's just how it went.
Yeah, it's so funny, like, hearing you talk about, oh, they were such great songwriters, and then I know them talking about, like, when they met you, they're like, wow, this guy's really good, let's write songs with him. You know, it's so funny to hear the different stories where everyone has their own introspective outlook and like, wow, that's a really good person, and you know, the other people will be looking back at you with the same opinion. And so fast forward now, a couple of years later, you're just after releasing your third album, and just to clarify, the name of the band is All the Luck in the World. All the Luck in the World, or if you abbreviate it, ATL, All the Luck, ITW. Wow, that's difficult. Atlishwa, it comes off the tongue a little bit easier. Atlishwa Music, All the Luck in the World. And so how did you guys finally decide to release your third album? How do you guys decide to release an album?
Yeah, it's just quite a natural next step for people, I think, once... I mean, releasing your first album is that what we're getting at here, or is it releasing the third one? Just,
yeah, well, just at any point, I suppose. I'd say more for yourself. How did you know you were ready to release another third album as opposed to release more singles?
Yeah, I mean, we never explicitly discussed this when we started being a band together, but I think one of the things that it's like one of the reasons, one of your sort of goals of being in a band is, yeah, we're going to make records, you know, like that's what we want to do. Like you want to put out bodies of work that feel really cohesive and that you're really proud of and that have substance to them and a story that's told through, you know, multiple tracks. And you know, it's there's no eureka moment where you sit up in the bathtub and go, oh my God, we've got to make a record. And then send a carrier pigeon to the lads. No, it's just you're just like, right, well, we're finished touring, and our record came out last year, so let's do another one. And then it's a case of getting the head down and getting stuck into the writing process.
And that's really interesting, the part of collaboration when you're working with two other friends but also very talented musicians. Is there any like tips you have for working together as, you know, a collective?
Yeah, well, I think that you that's a tough question.
Like, in my opinion, from my experiences, it's always good to have, like, if you could separate, someone has, you know, a specific job. So in certain cases, it might be like, if I was writing with you, I'd be like, okay, Ben, if you can come up with some cool chords, I'll think of some cool melody lines, and then maybe you could jam some lyrics. But like, I think getting a good format where everyone has their own designated job can be fun for, like, even if it's just for one album, say, okay, you're working on the drums for this, you're working on the chords for this, you're working on the lead vocal line, and you can kind of bring it together.
Yeah.
Or maybe it could just be jamming. That could be another way you could work collectively together.
Definitely. I think, well, you've all got to be serving the same purpose in some sense. And yeah, maybe not everybody can fulfill the same role in every instance of songwriting. So I think the main piece of advice there that I would have for people is try to leave everything at the table and put the song first always. And I think that as time goes by, that's something that you will just get better at doing and get better at working for the greater good of writing a great song, and not, you know, worry too much about who does what every single time. It can be different, and just, you know, really listen to each other. Like, I'd say I've learned more from the lads than I have from anyone else in music, and that's really through sharing ideas and perspectives and new music that you're listening to. And yeah, I mean, also just be a good person, right? Like, be nice. And like, obviously people who've, you know, have maybe difficulty in certain social aspects are going to struggle to collaborate, you know, artistically, or maybe in other domains as well. So just trying to be a good team player always. And yeah, I mean, that's basically all I can think of.
Like, just to go a little bit further on that, I think the nicety, like being nice and have compassion for your colleagues and listen to them. Don't just concentrate on your own ideas. You have to make sure, you know, you're not just waiting for the other person to finish their idea before you bring out your idea. It's about listening and be willing to be wrong, or not wrong, or just be willing to take other people's ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. It should never be a self-serving process. It should really always be about hearing other people. I mean, I think that one of the best things about writing music and about making music in general is the serendipity of the process. And it's hard to surprise yourself sometimes, but if you've got someone else, if you've got other people to bounce off, that happens way more often. And you need to be open and receptive so that when those moments come and you can feel that sense of, well, I can't believe we're writing this. This is not what I expected. It's really exciting. You know, you need to stay open in order to get there, you know?
Yeah, I love that. Yeah. But nothing like those moments of excitement when something, it just happens. And then you're like half an hour in, you're jamming, and the whole thing's just falling out of you.
Yeah, that's probably the best feeling, I think, for me.
Yeah, and especially working as a collective, that's something, it's on a whole nother level when it's with other people. And especially when they're friends, it's just totally different. And then, how much writing do you do before you go to the recording stage?
Well, I suppose we've experimented with that in the sense that, so this is our third record that we've mostly been, or that we were talking about earlier. And for the previous two records, we basically wrote 10 or 11 songs and said, that's the record. You know what I mean? Whereas this time, we took a slightly more measured approach and said, let's write about 20, 25 songs and see how we're feeling then. You know, not go super deep into the recording process. Just iron out some demos, and then we'll pick the best, 11 or 12, or the most cohesive group, basically. The hope is then the album sort of reveals itself to you, but of course it turned out to be more difficult than that, because there's still songs that you want to make out of those 25, which is good, because then you've got tracks for a future project, or for, you know, for the next endeavor.
Do you ever find writing and recording at the same stage leads to new findings, or you accidentally stumble upon something you wouldn't have done if you had done each stage as its own independent process?
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, it's good. It's good to have, like, for several reasons, it's good to have a little bit of gear set up when you're writing. Of course, you don't have to, right? You can write songs in your bedroom with an acoustic guitar and then go into a studio and do it all in the studio. But it's nice to have a little bit of stuff set up because, you know, maybe, like, let's say if you've got, I don't know, a synth loop or a sampler or something that you wouldn't usually use, but you get an element into the song early on, and actually it can kind of shape your vision for the track. So that's one thing. And the second thing would be that you might just capture a moment that's actually very hard to repeat. And this is why, you know, demoitis, which is what everybody talks about, where you might have a demo that you just can't see past. You know, you go to the studio, you do a an expensive version of that song, but it's not, it doesn't have the same, the something from the original, something intangible that you just can't get back, which is why I think it's quite helpful just to have like a good good vocal mic or a good setup just to capture things in case there really is something magic that you have in high enough fidelity, or in it doesn't even have to be high fidelity, but in a that you have captured that moment, you know, in a way that you're happy with.
Yeah, and actually, just to further upon that point, I think this might be very beneficial for the listeners, where, you know, we all spend ages and ages trying to buy more and more gear, but then it's interesting from the demoitis, it's encouraging to hear even if you don't have the best gear.
Oh yeah,
that the demo, because it's nearly in some ways lower fidelity than what your perfect recording afterwards would be.
Mm.
Do you feel like that's nearly encouraging for anyone who doesn't have all the gear they want?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, honestly, you could do a guitar take on your phone nowadays, and it might have some quality that you just can't get back. So like, there really are, as I've said probably to you before, when we talk about production between us, like, there's just no rules, you know, whatever you feel, whatever gives you that sense of inspiration is good enough.
Yeah, love it. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And there's so much to be said for just get the ideas out there and don't worry about what you're recording with. Like, the phones are absolutely amazing. Like, sometimes you record something that's just like, and sometimes you want that hiss if you're gonna, like, the kind of phone hiss that you sometimes get, and the interesting compression each phone has is just something unusual and cool about it.
Definitely, it's something we've always liked, the way that, I suppose, initially iPhones, and now I've got a different phone, but it seems to work kind of the same way. This sort of, the way that they compress audio has a certain charm to it, for sure. And I mean, we even use even half of one of the songs in the record is a phone recording. The first half of I've Been Trying is just recorded on our phone. So that's another thing we actually always do just before, if we are going to go into the studio or whatever, is we would do a session maybe where we sit down and play all the songs that we've written in like their most simple form, just to a phone or just to a simple one mic setup. Because I think that can be just a helpful like reference tool to have when you're working on songs further. Just like a really, you know, you might be working on a demo with all sorts of stuff going on, but it's great to have just one stripped back, really simple version, just to kind of cut to the heart of the song and see. It's a good reference point for seeing what it's really about and what really the deeper feeling behind all the textures is, you know.
And just before we go on to the producing stage, I have one more question about your writing style. It's funny, I'm back from a walk. I was out on the shore there.
And you inspired him?
Inspired, so inspired, listening to the music. And I was listening to, what's the French one?
Rue de l'Enfer.
Isn't it in 6/4 time?
No, I think it's in... I would kind of count it like 7, I think.
Oh wow! Okay.
Oh no! Sorry, it is in 6/4, right? It's like a 7 and a 5. It's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4.
This is where I'm getting the 6 from, because it's 7 and 5.
Yeah. So I guess it's just 6 with a push then.
Nice.
Yeah.
Super cool. And that was leading me to, and then you had another one, song called Talons, which has another.
Oh yeah. Well, that's more complicated for sure.
Really, really cool rhythms in it. And when you come to the writing stage and recording stage, are you trying to implement something unusual on, like, not on purpose, but like...
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah. I think we have done that more in the past, and we could do it more again. We didn't do it so much on this record, but I think little moments like that where you just put in an extra beat, or you just say, like, how could we make this a little bit more unusual, like, I think you can trust that it's gonna work a lot of the time, right? Like, it's, which is something that I wouldn't have, and it's something I learned in the band, I think, and actually something that I've learned since while film scoring, basically that, yeah, like you can afford to be a bit blunt and just like say, okay, here's a bar of 7-4 for no reason, and then you just it'll just grow on you, you know. You'll just like be like, oh, it's got this little bit where you think that's gonna happen, and then you can sit into it in a different way or whatever. So yeah, I enjoy doing that kind of stuff with the band, and then I also found that it works quite well in film scoring if there's like a certain, because obviously occasionally will be a moment where you want a cue to begin slightly earlier or slightly later, depending on what's happening in the picture. And sometimes it's a great, going back to this serendipity, sometimes it can be a great sort of realization where you're like, oh, actually, just adding in two extra beats was all I needed to do to make it to this cut of the picture. And what that extra two beats actually just makes the piece of music more interesting as well. So like, for sure, I think people can afford to be braver with that kind of stuff than they often are.
Wow, I love that. It's nearly like when you've experienced other types of music, you've taken inspiration from it and been like, wow, okay, adding extra beats is like, can do something different. And then you implement that into your folk style with the band. That's really cool. So I suppose the advice there is make sure you experiment with lots of different types of genres to to learn from them.
Yeah, change time signature. It's fun.
it's so cool. And if anyone listening hasn't listened to the album yet, do check it out. I'm a sucker for a time signature change. I don't know what it is. There's just something about it. so good. And then when you hit the producing stage, so this recent album, you had a producer with you, although I think all three of you are producers by your own right. How do you find it working with another creative soul in there in the production stage?
Yeah, we worked with two separate producers on the last record. And I think it's, you know, like it's very enjoyable. Like, whether you're working alone or working in a band, you can still end up in quite an insular space with regards to your own music, and it is very useful to get another input in the recording stage. And similarly to collaborating with your bandmates, it's good to be open to ideas and to hear the other person's perspective and to allow them to influence the music for the better, you know. And of course, it's their job to help you realize your vision of the music. So, yeah.
All about that, just creative minds coming together and creating something unique but that you wouldn't have on your own. It's just a beautiful thing. And would there be any kind of production techniques that you use on this album that would be unique or new or that you found very exciting?
I think, going back to what I said earlier about the phone, there's quite a bit of like sort of field recordy stuff, or like, I don't know, just we used a lot of recordings. So for example, I've been trying, the first half is just us playing this song with two like a phone microphone, and then there's Patterns, which that track, basically the demo of that was built entirely out of like pitched resampled phone recordings of like guitar parts and stuff like this. So we did a lot of chopping up of audio and pitching things around and moving it up and down, just things to take already captured sounds to like interesting spaces. And we slightly leaned away from sort of more traditional performance-based orchestration and a little bit more into like that world of chopping things up. Like, for example, you would have played some violin takes for us, which then on the record are sort of, they're resampled onto like an OP1 and pitched into different keys. So maybe you played violin for a specific track, but then we didn't use it there. We transpose it and chop it up into a rhythmic thing on a different track, for example. That would be one example of something a bit different we did, maybe.
Yeah, I love that. Very few of my violin playing is recognizable on the album, which I absolutely love. You just like, it's pure creativity, which is great. And how do you find much use for the OP1? Would you recommend people trying it out? If they managed to get their hands on one.
They're very expensive nowadays. Or like, I'm not gonna earn myself any fans at Teenage Engineering here, but I think it's definitely overpriced. Compared to what other samplers on the market will offer you for the same price. But that being said, it's a very immediate piece of equipment, and when I bought it, I bought it for about less than half the price of what the retail is now, because it used to be significantly cheaper at retail, and then I got mine secondhand. So would I buy one new for the price it is? I don't know. I mean, if people should obviously have a try to get into a local music store, have a mess around with gear and decide if it feels right for them, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember when you bought yours and I was like, oh, I pretty much heard about OP1s for the first time because you guys bought them a couple of years back. And then I started looking into them. And then the prices just started to keep going up. Anyway, we don't have to talk about that. What I do want to talk about, though, is, I don't know if anyone's seen my YouTube videos recently, I'm always talking about texture. But the only reason I talk about texture is because I've listened to you talk about texture so much. So how have you managed to bring texture? Like, it's all about bringing atmosphere, I suppose, into a track and making it feel like you're in a certain environment. How would you advise people to go about trying to add texture and atmosphere to their track to really make it seem like it's in a particular setting? Or it doesn't even have to be a particular setting or some sort of emotion.
Yeah. Texture has been a buzzword for us since we first started playing together, and a useful buzzword, because I think one thing that we probably all realized at the start of being a band was that we all had a fondness of sort of slightly unusual sounds or the atmospheric bed of a track, you know, something that sets the scene against maybe other more sort of traditional instruments that you'd hear in an arrangement. And the key to that really is totally just messing around, like sitting down and a bit like what I was talking about earlier, where you maybe try repitching things or putting things through effects and getting different sounds and then saying, oh, you know, maybe you stretch that out and it creates just a little bed for stuff to sit on top of, or sampling, like creating sample instruments and stuff like that has been a big one for us, where, I don't know, just for example, you might take a beer bottle and blow into the top of it to create that kind of whistling tone, and just record it and then bring it into your digital audio workstation and put it in a sampler, and then you've got, you know, an instrument that you can play out of that sound, and you can run it through effects and stuff like that. So yeah, like, you got to record sounds and try to find interesting ways to use them, basically.
What synth would you use mostly for your own sampling?
I wouldn't really use a synth, or what do you mean?
Like, would you use a quick sampler in Logic to throw your sample into, or?
Yeah, in the past, like, the go-to sampler for us probably has been, like, EXS24, which is just, I think, the stock. I think they've changed it now, right? Is there?
Yeah, that's what the new sampler is, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not up to date yet because my laptop is so old that I can't get the new Logic, but yeah, basically just like it'll work, and you know, it will work with every digital audio workstation has their own sampler, more or less. I think Ableton, and I don't know if Pro Tools does, but, and usually it's pretty much as simple as dragging an audio file into the software and Yeah, and then you've got something to work with.
And just a side note, Ben, I really want to ask you, how did you record your drums? Because the drum sound on the album, it might just be because I struggle the most with drums out of any instrument area of the full sound spectrum. Drums are the ones I'm like so fascinated with because I'm not a drummer, but you yourself are a drummer. And the sounds on the album are amazing. The percussions, all percussive sounds, the drums themselves, the kicks and the snares, the rhythms. How did you go about it?
It's quite different from song to song, but so we did a drum session for a couple tracks. I think there's it's on five tracks maybe. We got a guy called Martin Roth, who's a drummer based in Berlin. We went to his studio and kind of just showed him tracks and showed him our kind of crappy demo beats, and we're like, this is what we want you to play, but more like this. And he was brilliant. I mean, not only was he a brilliant performer, but we went in with a good engineer as well, and I think we captured it really nicely. And it was quite, this is going to be my buzzword for the day, but it was quite serendipitous. You know, like, there's a lot of surprises in there where he might play something slightly not what you expected, or might get something wrong, but you're like, no, that's deadly. Or you might do a take where you say, okay, just really kind of go for it this time. Feel free to put a bit of spice in it. And you might find something special there. So yeah, I think that drum session was brilliant. And beyond that, for the other tracks, it kind of depends. Like, there's a little bit of drum machine stuff. Kelvin played some drums on some of the other tracks, which we recorded in like a kind of tiny little vocal booth in a different studio. So it's really just a mix of things.
Oh, and I just wanted to say, I just Googled the meaning of serendipity just to be sure all our listeners know exactly what it is. Because, you know, of course, I knew exactly what it means. but it is a noun, the occurrence and development of events by chance in a happy or beneficial way.
There you go.
There you are now, Ben. You've left us with some valuable knowledge there. Forget about the music making. It's all about our English learning. Serendipity.
There you go.
Love it. Okay, wow. I think I could talk about producing for ages as it is. Like, you can probably tell it's my baby. I love producing, just throwing stuff at the wall, seeing what sticks. And then, the rough bit after you've had too much fun in the producing stage, you have to decide a moment where you feel like, okay, we've enough sounds in this song for now. It's time for mixing. How do you know? How did you know that your songs were ready to go into the mixing stage?
Well, at some point in the studio, we usually the whiteboard comes out, and we will kind of have, you know, we might be talking through the songs we're doing, and we'll say, right, well, what's left to do here? You know, what have we not got around to? And is there anything that we want to try as like a last minute kind of curveball on the track? And so we'll just make, let's say there's 10 tracks on the record, we'll just make 10 lists on a whiteboard, and it'll say, you know, usually it'll have whatever sort of mock title we're using because we haven't even thought of the song name at this stage. And then just, you know, it could be, you know, we still have strings to do on this. Do we want to try, you know, like some extra percussion, or do we want to, you know, anything really, you know, throw some curveballs at it last minute. But then usually, like, obviously you can't go on forever. And I think you just kind of know, right? Like, everybody's in the studio. There's nothing left. And as long as the track is set, as long as everyone's feeling like this is sounding really good, then that's the time to call it really. I think in the past we've definitely gone too far with adding layer upon layer to tracks and then discovered afterwards that it's actually taken something away from the song.
That's always a danger, isn't it? Just, oh, I need something more. And especially after you've listened to your song so many times, it can kind of lose perspective sometimes. Have you ever felt like you guys sometimes can lose that, you know, you've really listened to too much, you need to...
100%, yeah. Like, it's a very easy trap to fall into, I think, where... When you're working on something in so much detail and for so long, you get really caught up in the finer aspects of it. And sometimes, and this is why it's good to have, like, why it's good to have a producer involved or a couple of people to show your stuff to, is because they're taking a more of a wide angle lens look at what you're working on. Whereas your head is glued to the microscope, which is not always a good thing. So it is good. It is good to ask, you know, to get other people's opinions and to try to allow yourself to zoom out and see that actually maybe this little element that I'm working on is not adding that much to the track, or it's maybe it's nice, but it's obscuring something else in that frequency range.
I'm a big fan of that analogy you just used there. Your head is stuck firmly to the microscope and you just have to zoom out. That's actually such a beautiful analogy, because it happens all the time, doesn't it? You're so like, oh, is that kick right? We need more sub in that kick, or we need more click in the kick, or however microscopic you want to go.
Yeah, I mean, and it's important. Like, it makes a, like, often getting the finer details right is the difference between a great song and a, or a great recording and a not so great recording. It's just having the perspective to know that what you're doing is actually really necessary and really serving the track.
Great. Yeah, big fan of that. That's that's one for us all, no matter how experienced you get. Managing to keep perspective is difficult, and keeping on track.
It is, yeah.
Of course, having other people there definitely does help, for sure.
Yeah.
And when you were mixing the tracks, were you mixing them when you had it up on the whiteboard? Was it like, were you consciously trying to keep them, you know, coherent, the sounds to be similar, stuff to be done on each of the tracks to make them run into each other, or... Was it? What would you approach each track on its own individually?
I think that sense of them being cohesive is something that should sort of come about naturally. Like, you don't want to be listening to a track and then saying, "Okay, we're going to actually redo the guitar on this because it feels completely different to the rest of the record." I think that. That comes in the writing process very often, and then if you record all the stuff, you know, with the same person or in the same studio or with the same band, it's probably just going to sound like cohesive.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And then when mixing stage is finished, how did you guys go about sending it to a mastering engineer, or did you have multiple mastering engineers and compare?
Yeah, the last two records we've done comparison jobs, which is good. I mean, it's interesting just to do it anyway, at least once, right? Just to see how they can be different. And yeah, so, I mean, I think for our second record, actually for both records, we had three people master one track and then do a blind test and see which one you're gravitating towards, you know?
And what kind of things would you be listening out for? Is it like a color? Is it a loudness? What are you looking out for when you're hearing masters that come back?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, it's good to listen to them in a few different systems for a start. And I think you'll often might find that initially they sound very similar, and then the differences that initially seem subtle might be more pronounced once you've listened to it a couple of times, and then you have a better idea of what it is you're hearing. Generally speaking, like, it's hard not to just hear them and just compare them to each other, right? So, like, you would say maybe Master A is a bit brighter than Master B, or Master A is a bit less compressed than Master B, or whatever you like. So it's just keeping an ear out for those things. And at the end of the day, I suppose you can only just go with whatever sounds best to your own ear, you know. And not maybe different people will have different taste when it comes to mastering as well. Like, we might both listen to masters, and you might prefer a slightly more compressed master than I would, you know, or you might prefer it slightly brighter than I would. So it is really, at the end of the day, yeah, you just have to listen to them and decide which one you like the best, you know. But I would recommend getting us to everybody getting another set of ears on your masters, like an independent, if you've got a friend who's a mixing engineer or a mastering engineer or even just a producer or someone else who makes music, it's good to get their opinion too. They might hear something that might change your mind.
I think having friends who you can, you know, get advice from and just have, yeah, bounce it off their wall and just see what they think. Yeah, big help.
Mm.
And how do you find much using the car test, having it listening to it in the car?
Oh, the car test is the worst. It's really always tough. I don't know, does it really depend on the type of genre of music or is it just bad for everybody? But definitely listening to, I mean, if your record sounds good in a car stereo, the chances are that it's going to sound good everywhere else. But there are tricky things, yeah. Yeah.
The moment of truth. The car test.
Yeah, yeah.
Has to be done.
A moment of disappointment.
Yeah, absolutely. And then setting a release date. When did you know, or what were you aiming for a release date? Is there a certain time of year that's good to release an album?
That's a good question. And I think it really depends, and it's probably, the answer to that question has probably changed quite a bit over time. Like, nowadays with like mood playlisting and the seasons and all of that, I actually think it does kind of make a difference when you release a record. So like if you're releasing a poppy album of kind of, you know, up-tempo, dancey, fun music, then maybe like November is not the time for that. I don't know. But I would have thought, personally, I think of that as more of a summer album. So there's like there's artistic considerations to be made there in terms of maybe what time of year you feel like it suits the vibe of your music to release. I think it's not always going to be important, right? Like, I think you can obviously just put music out whenever you want. But then in terms of setting a release date, I think it just depends on when you're finished, right? Like, I think some people can go into that project and be like, okay, I'm going into the studio in June and we're finished in recording in July. And so the record is going to come out in November, and they plan everything ahead like that. We're not that type of band, because things always take a bit longer for us than expected. And I'm pretty sure even our first record got pushed back because we tried to take more of a approach where we were like, we'll have it out by the end of the summer or something, and it just didn't work at all. So, so let's say once you're completely wrapped up as well, I think, you know, most music industry heads will tell you that you should probably have like at least a three-month buffer to the release where you can, you know, allow your music time to be produced physically, and have sufficient time to send it out to press and to release a few singles and that kind of stuff. So it really depends.
And actually, that's an interesting point on the single release. Will there be a number of singles you think you should release? In this day and age, is it better to release lots of them so people pretty much know the album already?
Yeah, I don't know, to be honest. Like as a myself, I think it's really cool when someone will just drop a whole record, but I can understand why that doesn't make sense for artists when they're trying to build up to something and they're trying to create it, to get people on board, to come on a little journey for them with a couple of months, that sort of that finishes up with the release of an album and a sort of a natural climax. So we kind of, this time we tried to release quite a few more singles because we thought we want to try reach as many people before we put the record out as possible, and to, you know, appease the playlisting gods. But it didn't really work this time, so I can't say for sure that I think it's better or not to release a lot of singles, but it is, I think it's definitely a nice thing to release maybe one or two, you know. It definitely, it gives you a little platform and says to people, hey, you know, we're back, we're going on tour, putting out new music, and sort of gives you a chance to try and garner a bit of momentum. But like I said earlier, I also think it's really cool when people are just like, here's an album, you know. That's a great way to hear music for the first time. Like, personally, I'd rather, like, as a consumer or of music, I would rather hear your record as one piece for the first time than hear tracks 3, 5, 7, you know, and 9. But as an artist, I feel the opposite way, because you want to build that momentum, right? You want to make sure people are paying attention to what you're doing before you do it. So it's a tricky one.
And it's nearly more palatable, isn't it? Really, like, say, especially in this day and age where our attention spans are slightly reduced, the more songs you know, you're getting to know some songs in between lots of songs you do know. So it's nearly more comfortable because you're not coming across like, wow, that's really different. Wow, that's really different. It's nearly more easily accessed in a way.
If you get them bit by bit, single by single.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I don't, that wouldn't bother me personally as a listener. I think I would enjoy hearing a group of songs all together.
Hmm. Yeah. And then you mentioned promotion. What promotion can you do on the run up before the release? Playing shows, you mentioned. Anything else?
Well, yeah. I mean, the game has changed significantly on this front, I think, in the last couple of years. And I have the sense that I'm not the best person to ask about this, because I feel like we've been somewhat left behind in the, not left behind, but sort of have failed to keep up in the social media age, like, with, not that we're that old, but like with Facebook and stuff. It was in the early days of Facebook, not even early days, but let's say 2014, 2015, it was quite easy to reach an audience, and we didn't really feel the pressure to post every day. It was a bit more chilled out, and you got a little bit more back from people in terms of natural reach and stuff like that. And nowadays it's a different ball game with social media. It's a lot more hands-on, and I think you'd probably be more equipped to talk about that than I would. So obviously that's one way of promoting your music. Then of course, yeah, as you mentioned, like, playing gigs is kind of, I mean, that's more than just promoting it. That's kind of very often the whole point of it. And then beyond that, of course, yeah, you can do more. It's funny, in times gone by, we would have just called it, you know, I would have just said make a live session, but I'm finding myself saying make more content. Like, and that, I think, really is what the way it's being framed nowadays is, creating content that people can engage with in online spaces. So whether that is music videos or live sessions or Q&As or all of that kind of stuff. And then the other thing you've got is more like public relations stuff. So like, you can hire a PR company to work on getting your music out to press, like to the written press, or to get new opportunities on television or radio, that kind of stuff. So those would be kind of the main ways that you go about that.
Yeah, it's super interesting the way things have changed so quickly over the last few years, where nearly social media, especially now the last 2 years, it's really hard to gig, nearly impossible. Well, it's impossible now at the minute. Trying to use social media and trying to find ways of engaging with your audience and your fans and trying to keep that going in the promotion stage, where especially when the gigs have disappeared, it's kind of a whole new ball game altogether, which is strange. On release day, is there anything you do in particular on release day to celebrate or to engage with the fans or in days gone by even?
I think it didn't work out this time because of COVID, but I think in general the best way to mark a release of a record is with a live event that you can spend with people and have a proper celebration. Like, because I think that the release day is often, at least personally, I find it quite anticlimactic because you've spent, you know, just so much time working on this project, and you feel so immersed in it and immersed in the finer details of it, and to then watch it just pop up on your laptop screen as a small icon in the corner of your Spotify screen and hear the track through a laptop speaker is, you know, it's a weird feeling, and it somehow doesn't feel like the send off that your music deserves, which is why I think it's great to have like a small show if people can organize that kind of thing. It's a really nice way to mark the occasion. And yeah, I'm sure there's a bunch of stuff you should do on social media as well, like post and let people know that it's out. And it's always great to like mark the album release with probably the release of one of the songs with the record that you're most proud about, maybe with like a video or some sort of extra piece of maybe visual content that people can engage with.
And what are you most proud about this album? throwing you the deep end there.
Yeah, so it's a really boring answer, but I really love the songs. Like, I love our previous records as well. Obviously, like, they're, everything we do will always have some kind of special significance for me, but I just felt that this group of songs that we wrote is the most mature, and I still very much feel like the self who wrote them. I'm sure the lads feel the same way. We just felt really confident in it this time around, the whole way through, I think, and still do. So yeah, the songs themselves are what I'm most proud of. Like the recording, I really enjoyed the recordings. I think they went very well too, but like, especially now with this absence of gigging, I feel even closer to the songs and the idea of doing them live and taking them to another space. So yeah, I'm still really proud of them and looking forward to hopefully, yeah, taking them somewhere new when we finally get to go on tour.
Amazing. Ben, thank you so much for having a chat with me today. I thoroughly enjoyed it, so I hope everyone else did.
It's a pleasure, Hugh. Best of luck with the podcast.
Well, look, I really enjoyed the podcast because, you know, you can get your ideas out instantly. Audio is so much faster where, you know, when you're editing video, it takes like 20 hours to edit it, where, you know, I can edit this hour long podcast in not so long, probably like an hour as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's a different, I love the idea. And also you can be productive while listening to something. You know, you can listen to a podcast, but make dinner, where it's very difficult to like be fully engaged watching a YouTube video and make dinner at the same time. You know, it's more just the audio experience.
Yeah, they're a very useful way to, you know, if you're multitasking, it's a nice thing to do if you're stuck in traffic. Listen to Hugh rambling, or me.
Well, rambling is certainly something you can get a lot of here, that's for sure. So Ben, where can people find you and All the Luck in the World online? Where should they check you out?
People can find us at ATLITW Music on Instagram and Twitter. Not that we're ever on Twitter. I think our Facebook is just / All the Luck in the World. And yeah, obviously people can check out our records on Spotify. We have three albums up there. So,
and what albums they are, Ben. What kind of albums they are. Jeepers. Some good stuff. Some very good stuff. no better place to leave it. Right. Thank you, Ben. I'll chat you in a bit.
Thanks, you. Take care.
Cheers.